Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 3:22 p.m. and that is Central Time. Today is December 7th. I thought we'd kick off with Goldman Sachs. So the share dropped from the peak in 2011 and then bounced twice from the region of the 1,000-day moving average. It's also, I think, notable that the lows were right in the region of the peak from back in 2018. The more back history we look at, the greater the length of the base formation looks. So we're at a rather critical juncture because the price is pulling back. One thing that I think is especially interesting is when we look at what actually generates money for the company. So most people think of Goldman as being an investment bank, but investment banking really only generates about 25% of revenue. And asset management generates almost exactly the same. In 2020, revenue from asset management was about 8 billion, and in 2021, it was nearly 15. So that was a big jump. And it was a bigger jump than we'd seen in revenue from other sectors. So it's worth considering what's in the asset management business, because what's become increasingly clear to me, at least, is that what many hedge funds have been doing is outsourcing the hedging activity to Goldman Asset Management. And it's the alternatives portfolio within Goldman is what's driving the asset management business. So they're investing in things like property, but then they're also investing in things like private companies. So providing funding to small to medium-sized enterprises. And it's a portfolio approach. So there's the understanding, at least, that while one or two companies might fail, then you're going to be compensated because for taking the risk by the outsized performance of other businesses. And then let's just think about the trophy type companies that they're investing in. The example that I've been offered, or I've been told about, I should say, is let me see, what are they called? Surgery centers. So a group of doctors want to set up their own business. They're in need of capital. So they go off and they borrow, and then they set up these surgery centers. And that every dollar invested can turn a return of upwards of 25 times once the enterprise is up and running. And that's exceptionally favorable sounding. But of course, then there are going to be companies that don't do well. And then there are also going to be companies that do well in a bull market and then don't do well during a bear market. And well, we're entering a bear market, we're entering a recession. Next year. And 10-year yields were down today. And investors beginning to price in the potential that inflation isn't going to be something we're going to be nearly as worried about over the next 12 months. And instead, what we are probably going to have to start worrying about is deflation. So the 10-year yield was down 10 basis points today, breaking back below the 3.5% level. And it's been pausing around that area, which is the peak from back in June, for most of the last week and now falling through it. So there's, I think, the real possibility here that what we're going to see over the next year is a halving of yields. So the yield was somewhere around 4.25, and we could see them coming down to perhaps 4.125 or 4.15, or let's just call it the region of the 1,000-day moving average. That would be a really meaningful contraction in yields. And it goes part and parcel with what we would normally associate with the contraction in the size of the balance sheet. Initially, what's normal is to see yields go up during quantitative tightening and then subsequently collapse. We've seen that exactly the same phenomena between 2018 and 2019. Let's go back and look at that 10-year yield chart. Yields went up first in 2018 and then collapsed. and then they really collapsed during the pandemic. I'm not predicting there's going to be another pandemic, but we are looking towards a deflationary shock. So there's lots of questions then about what is going to happen next. Well, there's an almost cause and effect scenario that's unfolding right now in China. The Hang Seng has paused in the region of the 200-day moving average. It was down 600 points today, having right going right up there and kissed it, and this was a downside key day reversal. So it's a peak of at least near-term significance, and then the real test of whether we're back in a demand-dominated environment for Chinese stocks is going to be whether that 15,000-point level holds on the Hang Seng. And then if we look at the H shares index, well, we have a really similar phenomenon. And then the big question will be not 15, but 5,000. So these are going to be big psychological levels. Now, let's just think about what happened during the big run-up in pandemic figures and case numbers during the period in 2020. Well, the first thing is that China is not some different planet. It's populated with people just like everywhere else. And the pandemic is going to run through the population just like it did everywhere else. And the closest parallel is India. Now, of course, India has a much younger population and China has an older population. But we're not talking about an older population akin to Japan. Now, the fact is that they're removing the testing requirements. Well, that's a smart move. If you've decided that you're going to let the pandemic rip, you really are better off not testing at all, because the last thing you want are accurate figures, because it's only going to scare people. So the first thing to do would be to massage figures lower and reduce testing, and then simply allow the pandemic to run its course. China has already built several hundred thousand, if not millions, of plague hospitals. So they're there for a reason. They do anticipate that there are going to be hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of patients. And there could be hundreds of millions of cases by the time the pandemic peaks. But let's just think about what happened everywhere else. Then, because of people taking precautions individually, because of acquired immunity, then what happened everywhere else was that the number of cases peaked with about after about 3 months, and then come down rapidly. And that there's no reason to believe that that's not exactly what will also happen in China. Now, of course, there's going to be sensational reporting, but if they are removing some of the restrictions on movement and they have stopped testing and are abandoning this exceptionally draconian testing regime, then the number of cases is inevitably going to rise. So then let's think about what was the response everywhere else. Well, it was massive fiscal spending. And that's what China's doing. They need to make excessive liquidity available to try and support the property market, because we're heading into a quarter of really difficult economic activity for China. But then the pandemic will peak, and the quantity of cash that's been made available is likely to support the property market. So within the first half of next year, China's economy is likely to go through a difficult period and then come out of it. So the stock market has paused and is steadying here around the 4,000 level on the CSI 300. And we might see quite a bit of volatility over the next while. But I think there will probably be a low in Chinese assets in the first half of next year, simply because the pandemic will have peaked by then. Now, when we think about oil, There's lots of bullish reasons why oil prices should be going up, but it isn't. Prices are coming down, and it's, I think, particularly important to highlight that we have a contango. There might be a backwardation from four contracts forward, but in the first 4 month contracts, so at the let me think, this is January, February, let's see, all the way out to this is certainly the 4th month, J. So that would be the February contract. And we definitely have a surfeit of supply because of this contango. Now, it doesn't mean that prices are not going to be in backwardation for 6 months forward, because China's demand growth might start to pick up 6 months out from now. But it's likely to decline in the next 6 months. And economic growth internationally is moderating. Chinese manufacturing is rolling over because demand from everywhere else is starting to also roll over. Now, this I think is very important, that the number of containers is really contracting exceptionally fast. It peaked at over 10,000 at the end of last year. We're down to 2,200 and change, and the peak values in the decade before the pandemic was about where it is right now. So we've fully unwound excessive demand, and warehouse capacity is being built at an exceptionally quick rate. There's 67 million cubic feet, excuse me, square feet of warehouse capacity being built in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And that is more than the combined additional new construction that's going on in the seven next larger city locations. So it takes time for there to be a response to excessive inventory. And now we're going to see that response. There's going to be a lot of empty warehouse space within the next 12 months. Then I think it's also especially important that you continue to see companies like Taiwan Semiconductor suggesting that they're going to be building a new factory in Arizona. They anticipate producing 4 nanometer chips in Arizona next year. Well, sorry, then 2024. So that's an additional new supply. Now they're going to be dropping somewhere in the region of 20 to 40 billion to get that done. And we've seen this enormous flow of new cash coming into the semiconductor fabrication sector. So let's just look at that. Back in 2005, it got up to 30 billion, and that was a lot. It got up to about the same level in 2018. And then, as we come into 2021, we're well in excess of 80 billion. And it's places like Germany, Japan, and the USA are spending the money to build their new fabrication places. So there's going to be an enormous oversupply of chips within the next 2 years. And that shortage of what is really the low-end kind of chips, particularly those that go into automobiles, that's going to be gone within 2 years. And Taiwan Semiconductor is encountering resistance right now in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. ASML has held up somewhat better, and it's also had a somewhat larger rebound, but was in negative territory in here today. I think it would be really too much to hope for that prices are simply going to re-accelerate from here. Rather, it's much more likely that we're going to go into a volatile, ranging environment. Now, when we think about stock markets more generally, Well, the Nasdaq 100 is in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. It has paused below 12,000 in the region of the 200-day moving average, and there is potential for additional downside here. And companies like Amazon, which are emblematic of this huge move into warehouses and into data centers, into the cloud, and now more recently into advertising, well, continues to trend downwards. When we look at the relative performance of those eight largest companies relative to the entire market cap, well, we're going to start to see the relative weightings of these large companies diminish in the major indices. So, as we think about that relative outperformance rolling over, the worst effects on stocks, on stock market indices, are going to happen at the beginning of this downtrend. The further down the relative trend these companies go, the less impact they're going to have on those main indices. But then it's worth highlighting that the sector that's done best over the last 2 years is the energy sector, and oil prices are coming down. So we're due for a good sized correction in energy equities, and they're just beginning to pull back from the upper side of this range that's prevailed really for the last 12 years. Then let's think about the really big companies that have a bigger focus on natural gas. Well, US natural gas prices were a bit steadier in here today, but Shell got back up to test this 2500p level. And the more back history we look at, the bigger the range is. So this is an historic area of resistance, and I think it's likely that we're going to see at least some pause and consolidation. So certainly it's a difficult market environment, and gold prices continue to steady, and we're up $14 in here today, holding the recent low. We did have the downside key reversal 3 days ago, and no downside follow through. This continues to look like a pause in the region of the 200-day moving average, and the most important thing that's happened has been that gold has broken back above or has broken the medium term downtrend, or at least the downtrend over the last 6 months, and posted a failed downside break below the low in 2021, and more or less finding support now in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. So I do think it is likely that gold is going to continue to prosper. And as long as we're in a negative real interest rate environment, then gold will be more sensitive to dollar weakness. And the dollar is rolling over. So economic weakness is going to hamper the Federal Reserve's ability to continue to raise interest rates. And the bond yield coming down is suggesting that deflation is an imminent risk. Then the Fed has to do something to, or has to continue to try and get inflation under control. But to do that, they need to compress asset prices, and there's still a ton of money ready to be invested. And we're starting to see money getting pulled out of real estate investment trusts. There was another Blackstone property-related fund hit its withdrawal limits today. Now they said they're going to still continue to allow distributions to come out of that fund, but how long can that keep up for? And how long will it be before cash meets illiquidity in the re in the private equity sector? So the investors that have been most heavily exposed to private assets
And the unlisted portion of the market are charities, endowments, and pensions. And the reason that I think it's that the private pensions are less affected, well, I guess it's not so much that private pensions are less affected, but rather that the impact it's going to have on public pensions are going to be most acutely felt by governments. And there are a lot more people covered by public pensions, and not least because a lot of those are defined benefit. And that means that if when they start losing money, they're going to have to be recapitalized. And it's setting up a really significant problem and a dilemma for local governments in particular. I will give you an example that we discovered when we bought the house we're currently living in. We've got a voluntary HOA, but I do say voluntary with inverted commas around it. So what happens is that, or what happened was during 2008, the police department in Dallas basically their pension went bust. And it meant that the police department was essentially broke. So they couldn't recapitalize. And what happened instead was they put a freeze on hiring. And they've been trying to recapitalize the pension ever since. So then there was no new hiring and no pay rises for police. So, in order to supplement incomes, the local or several of the local neighborhoods started a whip around in the neighborhood, and they called it an HOA, and they basically pay off-duty police officers to patrol the neighborhood in police cars. Now, it works wonderfully in terms of public safety, and you end up with a very safe neighborhood. But what it is a reflection of is what happens to public services when public pensions go bust. And we should be thinking about that in terms of police forces around the world, fire station, firemen, teachers, nurses around the world, where these large pensions are going to run into significant issues when private assets start to underperform. And we haven't really seen the markdowns in or a mark-to-market event in this sector. They're not under the same pressure as public funds. But it is coming, and they were at least going to have to write something down at the end of the year. Now, they might only have to write down assets once a year, but there is absolutely no way that they were writing up assets at the end of last year that they're not going to have to write them down again this year. And I do think that this is where the epicenter of risk is. And it was a direct response to exceptionally low interest rates. Pensions had absolutely no choice if they were going to meet their obligations, and there was no additional cash to support their pension funds, then they went further out on the risk parameters, and they substituted yield for illiquidity. Or at least they substituted the reliability of bonds for the illiquidity of the illiquid assets or the private assets. And I do think that that is now a really significant issue. And I think it's also very telling that within the next decade, a lot of the most senior politicians in the USA in particular will, in all likelihood, be dead. And there'll be a massive transfer of power into a younger generation. Now, that has happened already in places like in much of Europe. The average age of the members of parliament and prime ministers and presidents is significantly younger. But we haven't had the change of policies yet. And that change of policies is coming. There's going to be much more onerous taxation of generous pensions. Because all of the spending that's gone on over the last couple of decades, and particularly during the pandemic, is going to have to be paid for. And that is going to represent a significant draw on public finances. And if one has a private pension and has the resources to increase it, then perhaps increase contributions, that might not be nearly as difficult as it's going to be for local governments and trying to meet the obligations of are the promises that they've made to all those public sector unions. And I do think this is going to be a really significant issue over the next few years. And then if we think about the dollar declining, well, the opportunities are going to be in emerging markets, but perhaps not urgently. And that we're going to have a lot of volatility as we move into a global recession. So the rupee continues to trend higher, excuse me, the dollar continues to trend higher against the rupee. And Indian inflation is now starting to ramp upwards. So inflation there has been contained to a certain extent because of the discount that they're buying oil at. And oil prices are coming down. But inflation is now starting to appear there. And that's putting pressure on the currency. And the government bond yields are firming from the region of the 200-day moving average. So there's the potential here that we might see some additional upward pressure on yields. And then the Nifty index is beginning to pause now and is still holding the breakout in nominal terms. It is overbought in the short term, so we may certainly get some pause and consolidation going on right now. And then let's think about other big high population areas. Indonesia is pulling back below the 200-day moving average. Singapore has exhibited a great deal of relative strength by simply going nowhere over the last couple of years, but it's a little bit overbought in the short term as well. When we then think about the UK, the pound continues to rebound, but the FTSE 250 is pausing in the region of the 200-day moving average. There's still the potential that there's going to be a significant recession in the UK. But I think that's going to create a really significant buying opportunity. And the UK is going to come out of this crisis in a better position. Valuations will be much improved. And I think there will be a more joined up way of thinking about how to solve a number of the questions that are outstanding about how to progress in a forthright manner now that Brexit is a reality. I think that the biotech sector is the one place where investors will have to look for solutions, because there are huge percentages of the population are moving into retirement. There are going to be large numbers of people that are going to be suffering from the ails of elderly parts of your life, and it's going to demand new solutions that are cheaper. And it doesn't mean that biotech is going to be completely immune during a recession, but it is likely to bottom first. I think it's particularly relevant to just highlight the fact that when we look at consumer discretionary, the kinds of companies that dominate the sector are Tesla and Amazon. And those are really big technology companies. Whereas there are plenty of other companies that are not nearly as heavily influenced by the technology sector. And I would pay attention to companies like TJX, which is very overbought in the short term, but their business model completely eschewed the migration into the online world. So they're not going to be overly discomfited from the decline of the cloud computing sector or the overbuild in warehouses. And certainly there's still plenty of people out there looking for a bargain. And Ross Stores had pulled back really aggressively in 2022, and it has also rebounded. And then if the kinds of companies that tend to thrive in a recession are those that either offer bargains or allow you to repair your car. And O'Reilly Automotive is also overbought. So it's even these companies that have done really well look really rich right now. And there's clear potential that even the best performing companies are going to pull back and consolidate. So I think with that, I'll leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.